If you don't get away from this green scam, your country is going to fail.
During his second administration, U.S. President Donald Trump has effectively ended America's role in international climate action. He has withdrawn from the Paris Agreement and set in motion the departure of the U.S. from the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, while heavily promoting fossil fuel initiatives in the name of unleashing American energy. In this Global Insight podcast, our speakers consider the implications of America's retreat, as well as efforts by other countries to collaborate on climate issues, which stand in contrast to the US approach. Sue Biniaz served as a lawyer and climate negotiator in the US State Department for nearly 30 years. She outlines the US position and what the withdrawal means.
As a practical matter, the US has kind of been acting de facto like a non-party since the beginning of the second Trump administration. They didn't send a delegation to COP30 or to the even to the subsidiary body meetings in Bonn about a year ago. They also stopped implementing their obligations under the agreements, including, you know, not submitting a report that was due about a year ago. So already we're kind of living in the world of U.S. non-participation, which, you know, it's quite a contrast from the first Trump administration. I would say, broadly speaking, and just with respect to the COP, but multilateral climate cooperation in general, it's definitely had a negative effect. I mean, climate has not even been a permissible topic at the G7 and the G20, for example. The U.S. has taken quite a negative approach at the International Maritime Organization with respect to this kind of net zero goal that was on the table, the NZF, the net zero framework. At the COP, where it's a consensus process, I think some in the world would say it's a good thing that the United States didn't come, because, you know, they would have been able to use their vote to block consensus if they didn't like the outcome. And they probably would not have agreed to the outcome that came out at COP30, because it would have been too forward-leaning on climate, even though it was quite a modest outcome. You could certainly sort of see the difference between a COP where the U.S. isn't there and a COP where a pro-climate U.S. is there, or, you know, could have been there in a different circumstance. You know, and a couple examples of that would be, you know, last year was a big year for the next round of NDCs, the nationally determined contributions. The ones for 2035 were due last year. There was a gap. It was clear from the kind of NDC synthesis report that there was a sizable gap between the NDCs that had been submitted and what would be necessary to keep the world on track to a sort of safe temperature goal. And, you know, that should have been one of the issues that was addressed pretty substantially in the outcome. I think if a pro-climate U.S. had been involved in COP30, you know, there absolutely would have been more on that topic. I don't think the U.S. would have accepted an outcome with where you needed to sort of squint to see a reference to the gap. Another example is, you know, one of the roles the U.S. traditionally played was brokering compromises between, you know, forces, ambitious forces and maybe less ambitious forces, or however you want to describe the different camps. But, you know, one thing we used to do is sort of talk a lot to China, talk a lot to Saudi Arabia, try to come up with compromises. There was a last minute effort on the part of Brazil to get into the consensus text the idea of a roadmap on transitioning away from fossil fuels. That didn't succeed for a number of reasons. But, you know, I think if a pro-climate U.S. had been involved, I think we would have been able to help broker some kind of compromise. It might not have been exactly a roadmap on transitioning away from fossil fuels in that exact phrasing, but I think that we would have gotten, you know, sort of more than came out.
Alden Mayer is a senior associate at climate strategy think tank E3G and a veteran observer of the UN climate negotiations. He says that some countries may be inspired to curb climate action as a result of the US withdrawal, while Washington continues to exert a significant active influence.
So far, we haven't seen any other countries follow the U.S. out the door on Paris. There were rumblings in the first term that President Milei of Argentina might do that, but I think he was convinced by advisors that doing so would disqualify Argentina from obtaining finance, whether loans or grants, for their domestic programs, and he backed off of that. It's hard to measure, of course, what the impact is on the level of ambition of other countries' commitments under Paris. There certainly would be an argument for the fossil fuel industry or others in those countries to say, with the world's largest economy and second largest emitter out of the regime, why should we take action to meet our obligations? But of course, there are other arenas in which the U.S. is actively pushing to slow down other countries from taking action. For example, the International Maritime Organization has been considering putting a levy on emissions of international bunker fuels used for shipping, which is a growing sector, still relatively small, but a growing sector in greenhouse gas emissions, trying to get the International Energy Agency to back away from some of the scenario analysis on net zero pathways and trajectories. And of course, actively promoting sales of U.S. oil and liquefied natural gas around the world. So it's not like the administration is just totally passive, sitting on the sidelines. They are actively intervening to try to advance their fossil fuel promotion agenda in other arenas, even though they've withdrawn from Paris and the Framework Convention.
The Trump administration's actions on climate, both international and domestic, will have repercussions long beyond the next few years, says Mayer.
I think this is going to have a much longer term impact than the first Trump administration did. They have gone after the regulatory infrastructure, for example, proposing to reverse the endangerment finding based on the 2007 Supreme Court decision that found that carbon dioxide was a pollutant under the Clean Air Act, endangering public health, and therefore the Environmental Protection Agency needed to take action to address that. We'll see where that goes. It's being litigated, obviously, in the courts, and it will take a while to work up to the Supreme Court. But if that was to be overturned, that would make it much more difficult for a future administration to proceed aggressively with regulatory authorities. Clearly dismantling a lot of the research and scientific architecture, whether it's NASA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, some of the other science programs, is going to have long-term damage. The U.S. has been a major provider of scientific observations and data and analysis for decades, and that is already being missed. And I think the impact on the federal workforce, and especially the scientists and technology experts that are leaving these agencies in droves, it's going to take a long time to rebuild that capacity. It's not going to be weeks or months. It's going to be a project of years. Another thing the administration did was totally eliminated the professional civil servants in the State Department's Office of Environment and Science that were leading the negotiations for a long time in both the UNFCCC since Rio in 1992 and the Paris Agreement. Again, that would take time to rebuild. Now, I think even if you get a pro-climate action president in 2029, there's a perception of the instability and insecurity of relying on the United States as a long-term partner.
Binias agrees and highlights that while the U.S. has never been historically reliable on the climate, the current situation seems more serious.
I think the U.S. is going to take a big hit in terms of its credibility and reliability. There's been quite a long history of U.S. zigzagging, or flip-flopping, I guess you could say, on international climate policy. This time, the withdrawal with a small W is broader and deeper. not only disengaging from all all discussions of climate in multilateral fora, but also kind of withdrawing, quote unquote, domestically. So, you know, I think it will be a lot more challenging to reengage effectively in the future.
Despite the Trump administration's position, Mayer says there are significant subnational groups in the U.S. who are continuing to take climate initiatives forward.
The silver lining here, of course, is that we have states and cities and companies and investors in the U.S. who remain committed to the Paris Agreement. They have come together through the coalition America is All In. The states, the 24 states that are part of that, collectively represent over half of the U.S. population and nearly two-thirds of the U.S. GNP. If they were separately a country, they would be the world's third largest polluter behind just the United States and China.
Other countries continue to engage with multinational climate initiatives. In April 2026, following a lack of progress in UN forums on the phasing out of fossil fuels, 57 nations, including major fossil fuel producers, met at a conference in Santa Marta, Colombia, to build a coalition of the willing. Colombia's Minister of the Environment, Irene Velez-Torres, explained the need for the conference in a statement.
We have received the confirmation by more than 50 countries, which means that this space is having a global attention. And part of the reason why is, first of all, because there has been an accumulated crisis in the multilateral spaces in which green agendas and a climate crisis has been discussed. Particularly, the COP30 showed a breaking point in relation to a group of countries trying to push into the agenda the discussion on the elimination of fossil fuels as part of the structural actions that are needed in a coordinated level at a global scale.
Alex Rafalovich, director at the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty Initiative, explains the significance of the conference and how it may ultimately influence non-participants.
I felt like the conference was a success even before it started because it had catalyzed so many conversations about how do we transition away from fossil fuels. We saw regional and national meetings. We saw, I think, over 2,000 kind of submissions of proposals and ideas. There were all these structures to engage different stakeholders, academics, indigenous peoples, the private sector, trade unions. You know, so it really did break the dam in terms of having a real conversation about what the transition required. And in terms of outcomes, there was three parts of the conversation. So the participants, which included the non-government and government officials, talked about how to overcome economic dependency on fossil fuels and what was policymaking required to do that, including labor conversion and just transition policy and planning and economic diversification. They talked about aligning supply and demand with climate goals. And then three, how could we accelerate international cooperation and enhance governance on this issue, and where and what are the gaps? What are the limitations of the UNFCCC? What are other opportunities? There was skepticism when this idea was first proposed that, you know, countries would engage in it or were ready for it. I think possibly accelerated by what we saw with actions in Venezuela and Iran, there was actually a heightened awareness that the fossil fuel-based economy is one that is very susceptible to power plays and military intervention and actually represents a risk for energy security and stability for many countries. And so we saw, I think, 57 countries were present in Santa Marta, and that represented about a third of global GDP. There were many fossil fuel producers present. Colombia itself, of course, I think is the fifth largest exporter of coal. It's one of the third largest oil producer in the Americas. The United Kingdom was there, Ghana was there, Nigeria was there. So there was a range of fossil fuel producers present who were willing to have a conversation about the need to end the expansion of the industry and look to phase out. And that, I think, leads to the next stage, which is, or the next part of the question, which is the logic of the proposal for a fossil fuel treaty and the proposal for a dedicated conference was not to create a universal agreement. The idea was to, how could we find the states and actors who are interested in actually doing this and seeing what they could achieve collectively that they can't achieve alone? And how could that accelerate change in the international system? When you create a new form of international cooperation or a new agreement, you can change what happens on several levels. You change what individual governments are able to do because they build a political alignment, commitment to doing the peace. You change what happens between those countries that are committed to the idea, and you change, they are able to accelerate action on things that they couldn't do alone. But you also do impact the non-participating countries, either by a flow on normative effect, where they feel pressure to have to comply with what other states are doing, or and through a market effect where, you know, if a third of global GDP starts to really drive in one direction, you'll get a clear acceleration of the effect we're already seeing of the transition, and that will create pressure on the non-participants to join or to act, if not join.